The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been looking at, essentially, at quotes from evolutionists dealing with the general difficulty of trying to attribute evidence for origins to science. And I think we have given a reasonably representative view of that, so I will get on to something else. We're dealing with a area that I have chosen to call simply general objections to the theory of evolution. There is some overlap between these, and in at least one case, a definitive response, I think, will have to wait until we spend some time looking at fossils. And it is my intention to do that in the not-distant future. But a second of these general objections is simply there is no satisfactory mechanism which has been found to explain changes from one kind to another. Now, it probably would be helpful at least to talk a bit about the idea of kinds. That term, of course, is a biblical term. It is not a taxonomic term. It's not a term that is used in biological classification. It is my opinion that the term kind, the biblical kind, is probably at about family level in the taxonomic scheme. And we could look at certain examples of this. I'm not sure it would be profitable to try and do this on a 15-minute radio program. But the thing that we're getting at here is, again, there simply is not any persuasive mechanism that anyone is aware of dealing with the manner in which evolution could have occurred. There was a Canadian scientist, Dr. W.R. Thompson, who for many years was the director of Commonwealth Institute of Biological Control at Ottawa, Canada, and a world-renowned entomologist. He was asked to write the foreword to the new edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, which was published in the Darwinian Centennial Year as a part of Every Man's Library series. Now, Dr. Thompson, if my recollection is correct, was not an evolutionist. And the fact that he was asked to write this foreword is testimony to his credibility as a scientist. But his comment, I want to read one paragraph out of that introduction to that edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species. Quote, "As we know, there is a great divergence of opinion among biologists not only about the causes of evolution, but even about the actual process. This divergence exists because the evidence is unsatisfactory and does not permit any certain conclusion. It is, therefore, right and proper to draw the attention of the non-scientific public to the disagreements about evolution. But some recent remarks of evolutionists show that they think this is unreasonable. This situation where men rally to the defense of a doctrine they are unable to defend scientifically, much less demonstrate with scientific rigor, attempting to maintain its credit with the public by the suppression of criticism and the elimination of difficulties is abnormal and undesirable in science," end quote. And I am heartily in agreement with that. We spent some time way back yonder somewhere talking about the difference between science and scientism. And I defined scientism at that time as holding a view which is unwarranted on the basis of facts. And what has happened is that much of what appears, unfortunately, even in some scientific textbooks, is really scientism. It is coming to conclusions that are not warranted on the basis of the facts available. And when we start trying to wrestle over the question of how does one kind of organism change into something else, there is not evidence for that. There is not an evolutionary basis which is satisfactory to explain those kinds of differences. Here there are recent evolutionists who are very plain. Stephen Gould is one example of this. Let me read a couple of quotes from Gould because I think it may be pertinent here. For most phylogenies based on fossils rely on flimsy data. Rather, we wish to demonstrate that most cases presented as falsifications of punctuated equilibria are circular because they rely not upon clear evidence, but upon the gradualistic presuppositions they claim to test. Richard Goldschmidt, who was probably one of the best-known geneticists in the United States back in the 20s and 30s, did a tremendous amount of work on Drosophila and much of the pioneering work in early genetics. And he has some very interesting observations. Quote, if one tries to work out this idea in detail, one soon comes to the point where it is evident that something beside neo-Darwinian tenets needed to explain such macroevolutionary processes. The difficulties already encountered on the specific and generic level seem to the present writer to be insuperable at the level of families, classes, orders, phyla, and so on. These are, and for those of you that don't know, these names simply represent increasingly larger, more encompassing levels of classification. Now, if there are difficulties in showing how a species, how an organism in one species can change into an organism in another species, the next level above that would be genus. The difficulties are increased immensely. But by the time we get to the upper level of categories, there simply is no evidence that these kinds of things have happened. Now, kinds would have to be put at that level. The Bible does not teach fixity of species. If you are familiar with all of the furor that went on with the Scopes trial, this was one of the areas that was discussed at some length about that. Brian attempted to defend that idea. And the reason I'm so dogmatic about this is that the Bible never uses the word species. It does make comments about a category which it refers to as a kind. And there are a few of the kinds that we obviously know the limits of, the most obvious being humans. All humans belong to the same kind. It is my opinion that there was probably a cat kind, a dog kind, a horse kind, etc. So this is the level that we're talking about here, and the objection has to do with evidence that would indicate the movement, the gradual change from an organism that is in one kind of these, one classification, to a different kind. Now, in recent years, we've had all kinds of examples that some people look at as being answering the difficulty. I've seen pictures, for example, of cabots, animals that are supposed to be intermediate between cats and rabbits, and goats that are supposed to be intermediate between goats and other things. Again, a 15-minute radio program is really not the ideal place to try and discuss all of this because, in the first place, it requires some knowledge of genetics. And I would observe in passing that any scheme that the evolutionist is going to come up with has to be something that will work in nature. It's not something that can be done in the laboratory, but it's something that can occur in nature without any assistance, man-made or otherwise. And all of these sorts of things, the examples that I have just mentioned to you, really don't last long in nature. In some cases, I think we know the basis for them, know why they exist the way they do. And in some cases, it's simply because of some tinkering in the genetics lab that at one time very few people would have thought would have been possible. And I've tried to school myself in recent years to be very careful in saying that this or that or the other is something that simply can't be done. Some things that I would have thought not possible at one point, I can see or at least look at pictures of. We need to be careful about that. A couple other comments by Goldschmidt I think are probably worth noting here. It is hardly surprising that a number of zoologists, botanists, and paleontologists were not convinced that such a scheme could work. Certainly the evolutionary steps leading from a reptile to a bird should be infinitely more numerous than those leading from one kind of bird to another. This would be a change within a species. But neither in this nor in any other comparable sense, a comparable case of macroevolution, has more than an indication of these theories been found. It is true that nobody has thus far produced a new species or genus, etc., by macromutation. It is equally true that nobody has produced even a species by the selection of micromutations. In the best-known organisms, like Drosophila, fruit flies, innumerable mutants are known. If we were able to combine 1,000 or more such mutants in a single individual, this still would have no resemblance whatsoever to any type known as a species in nature. Now, here's some rather important comments by a very, very knowledgeable evolutionary botanist. Now, let's look. There's one comment in particular that Stephen Gould made that I think is certainly worth our noting. Quote, "The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as a trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils," end quote. Now, for those of you that may not have some background in science, these quotes, I don't know how meaningful they will be to you. But the reason I have chosen them is that they are simply examples of evolutionists, knowledgeable evolutionists, who are admitting basically this objection I'm raising, namely that we do not have a satisfactory mechanism to show how one kind of organism can change into any other organism. And if that is the case, then it presents a very formidable problem to the whole idea of evolution to start with. If evolution is universal, as widespread as evolutionists claim that it is, then evidence for it should not be difficult to come by. It ought to be apparent on every hand. And yet we find the exact opposite. As these evolutionists have indicated, the evidence for what happened is simply not available. It's not persuasive to show that changes of this kind of thing have ever happened.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.